All right, Erev Tov to everyone. Tonight is the is part 8 of our series, The Presidents and the Jews. Hello? And it's not working. Just as well. Sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Reb Aryeh Leib. And tonight we discuss Abraham Lincoln. So we've been combining several presidents in one lecture, the last few lectures, and for good reason. But Abraham Lincoln deserves his own and more. He's widely acknowledged as the greatest president ever, at least in the top two or three. And Lincoln faced challenges that no other president ever faced. Actual secession and civil war. No president ever had to confront the prospect of the dissolution of the United States. Few presidents have been so admired and so vilified in their lifetimes and then after. Keep in mind, Lincoln's birthday was never a national holiday. It was a state holiday, and primarily in the northern states. It was never celebrated in the South, to say the least. So Lincoln was a fascinating character, which is also an understatement. Probably no president has been researched more, had more books written about him, been scrutinized and psychoanalyzed more than Abraham Lincoln. And in addition to my normal research, I relied very heavily on the easiest book ever written for this topic in history. Book came out last year. I thank distinguished member of our shul for giving me a copy, entitled Lincoln and the Jews. How good is that? By Jonathan Sarna and Benjamin Chappelle. Chappelle makes a hobby out of collecting Lincoln memorabilia, and the book is filled with copies of Lincoln's letters and pictures, of which some he has the only copy extant. And Lincoln had a very special relationship with the Jews of his time, and he was the only president ever to carry a name straight from the Chumash. Think about that. Abraham. Only person who's close is Harding, Warren Gamliel Harding, all right? And Gamliel ben Pedatzur was a Nasi. But aside from that, he's the only president who has a biblical name from the Chumash. And not a few Jews during his lifetime and after his death and others always refer to him as Father Abraham, Avraham Avinu. And he's also the first president whom Jews tried to co-opt, claiming that he was a descendant of Jews, and we begin with that. You know, strange. No Jews ever sought to claim that Pierce or Buchanan had Jewish ancestors. I wonder why. But not so with Lincoln. Lincoln was born on Lincoln's birthday, by coincidence, February 12th, 1809, the exact same day that Charles Darwin was born, a point I noted almost 7 years ago on the bicentennial of their births. Two major thinkers in the 19th century, one born into an impoverished American family, the other one born into a wealthy English family, and they both came into prominence, really, at the same time. Darwin in 1859, with the publication of On the Origin of Species Through Natural Selection, and Lincoln with his election a year later, which in short, very short course, provoked the Civil War. So we'll return later to some of their similarities and differences, and how each, again, born on the very same day, each of them essentially posited a different view of mankind. Lincoln was born in a log cabin, had very little formal education, but he became extremely well-read. The truth is, his parents were not well-off, but nor were they dirt poor. His father managed. His father, Thomas Lincoln, and his mother, Nancy Hanks, were both from Virginia. Although Lincoln was born in Kentucky, as a child moved to Indiana with his parents, although Abe Lincoln's mother died when he was just nine years old, and that played a role in his upbringing as well. His father was a bit of a difficult person. His ancestors came apparently from the town of Lincoln, England, which indeed had a Jewish community dating back to the 1150s. Now, the Jews of England, you know, suffered immeasurably. There was a massacre in York in 1190. There was a blood libel in Lincoln in 1255, after which 18 Jews were executed. And the expulsion from Spain in 1290, to which Jews then did not return to England until Oliver Cromwell brought us back in 1656. So it's almost 350 years, more than 350 years later. If Lincoln had Jewish ancestry, it was well hidden. His grandfather was named Mordechai. In fact, in his immediate ancestors, go up the chain, almost every two, three generations, the names Mordechai and Abraham recur with frequency. But I'm not convinced. I mean, the fact is, biblical names were never uncommon in England, as we saw from the Puritans. But it's true. Isaac Mayer Wise, the famous Reform rabbi of his day, eulogizing Lincoln, quoted a meeting he had with Lincoln. He said as follows, "Brethren, the lamented Abraham Lincoln believed himself to be from our bone and flesh of our flesh. He supposed himself to be a descendant of Hebrew parentage. He said so in my presence, and indeed he possessed the common features of the Hebrew race, both in countenance and features." Lincoln's son Robert later said that he thought this was just a pleasantry on his father's part, and Lincoln was a good storyteller and loved the tall tale as well. So he might have just been humoring Wise, but nonetheless, Wise and others then ran with it, and that became part of the narrative which endeared him to Jews in the century after his death. That really, you know, Abraham, good president, great president, so we have to claim some credit for him. Lincoln also never identified with a particular Christian denomination. In fact, it played a role in his early political career when he didn't at first admit that he was a Christian of whatever belief. And he wasn't by nature a churchgoer either, although he would accompany his wife on occasion to church. But he was a great believer in God and providence, and especially, this can't be emphasized enough, God is the source of all human morality. He was an habitual reader of the Bible from youth and could quote from it liberally. And his writings and speeches were always sprinkled with biblical verses, imagery, allusions, and much more the Tanakh, almost 6-to-1 than the New Testament, to an extent that had not been seen since the early founding fathers. And he considered the Bible, he wrote this in a letter, God's greatest gift to man. And during the war, he regularly read it, turned to it for solace, for broader meaning in life, for guidance. As Lincoln was challenged not only by the dour politics of his time, but by a very tragic personal life. He apparently suffered from a number of physical ailments. It's widely rumored that he endured Marfan syndrome, known to afflict very tall people. He was 6'4", very tall for his time. He married Mary Todd when he was 33 years old, 1842, after he had been engaged to another woman, Anne Rutledge, but she died. Then he was linked to two other women, and then he met Mary Todd, and he knew even before the wedding that she was unwell, probably a manic depressive. And Lincoln himself had depressive tendencies. They broke off the engagement, and then within a year they reconnected, or a little over a year they reconnected and married, but she suffered her whole life. And it's brought down in many, many books. She was abusive to Lincoln. She would hit him in public, even as president. She once whacked him in the face with a piece of wood while he was reading a newspaper. Just like that, she would scream at him in public, and he would not respond. Her mental state and his mental state were not helped by their children. Of their four sons, only one, Robert, survived to adulthood. He eventually became the Secretary of War in the Garfield Arthur administrations. One son died in infancy, and maybe the most tragic of all, it changed their lives, that his son Willie died of a fever in 1862, age 12, while they were both in the White House in a very difficult time in the war. So Lincoln plunged into a deep melancholy. He did not do any work for 4 days, which to us sounds like nothing, but apparently, as president, and generally that was not the way they behaved, but nothing compared to his wife, who was never the same after that. She always had premonitions that some would try to kill him. That came true, unfortunately. She got so bad after Lincoln was assassinated that Robert had her temporarily institutionalized in 1875. So Lincoln's home life was troubled, although he faithfully stood by his stricken wife, and true to the bad mazel they had domestically with the South having surrendered, Lincoln suggested April 14th, 1865, that they go see a play after having endured so much sadness for years. Well, they've seen other plays also, but they never made it to the second act. We'll get back to that as well. Now, Lincoln's dominant character trait was a sense of fairness, of justice, and it led him to eventually oppose slavery. He didn't always. Mary Todd's family were slave owners, but it enabled him in the last two decades of his life, really three decades of his life, to befriend many Jews. Just out of fairness, he saw no reason to discriminate against any person because of religion, and Jews always held a certain mystique for him as Israelites, the people of the Bible whom God had protected and sustained for millennia. He was always conscious of that, and Lincoln was very well aware of our history through the Tanakh. Lincoln was tall, as I mentioned. He was awkward. He was gangly. He spoke in a high-pitched, even reedy voice, unlike the way most people imagine him today. He was quite homely, is the best way to say it. And because of his height, his long arms, and dark, weathered face, he was lambasted, lampooned, ridiculed publicly for his appearance. One of his top generals, whom he later fired, General George McClellan, referred publicly to Lincoln, it was his president, commander-in-chief, as a well-meaning baboon. But those type phrases were not limited to McClellan. Politics was very rough back then as well. And then many people maintained, probably with some cogency, that Lincoln's personal features, his face and voice, were such that he could not get elected today. In these shallow, superficial times in which we live, when candidates are judged by appearance, by their clothing, by their personal likability, would you want to have a beer with them, and other inanities, but maybe that's why we're not electing Lincolns anymore. So Lincoln first opened the general store with a friend, then he passed the bar in 1836, moved to Springfield, Illinois, and opened a law practice with a partner. And Lincoln always had partners and was always surrounded by friends. He had a marvelous sense of humor, earthy at times. He was an outstanding raconteur. He was one of these guys. I've met them on occasion. They're a bottom like this as well. They have a story, a parable for everything. Say, good morning, reminds me of a story. Well, Lincoln was like that. But he could also make them up on the spot. And his law practice was very successful. His biographies are filled with some of the cases he handled and the clever arguments that he used to convince judges or juries of his client's side. And he won the nickname Honest Abe. You know, it's good for the Bali Musa. Just give you one story that happened later. He became president, of course, March 4th, 1865. And he was signing the stipulations for his pay. And he crossed out the first of the month and made it the fifth of the month. He would be paid on the fifth of every month because he said he didn't work 4 days in March, so he can't take a full salary for that. Right? All right. We're all like that. Sure. In Illinois, at that time, he became friendly with Abraham Jonas. Jonas was an English Jew born into a religious family who moved to the U.S. in 1817 and himself became a lawyer in 1838. Now, Jonas married the daughter of Gershom Seishas, we've spoken about a number of times, who was of Sherith Israel in Manhattan, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, the Chazan. And his brother, Jonas's brother, married another daughter of Gershom Seishas. Together they moved out west and the brother started the first shul in Cincinnati. He moved to Kentucky. Jonas was elected to the state legislature, became, like Lincoln, an avid supporter of Henry Clay. He moved to Illinois in 1842, and in that capacity, he struck up a long friendship with Lincoln, who later referred to Jonas, and in his letters, only to Abraham Jonas, as one of my most valued friends. They were both lawyers, both community-minded people. They spent a lot of time together, professionally and socially. Jonas became irreligious over time, unlike his brothers, and he or Lincoln writes that they once dined together at an oyster saloon. All right. But everyone knew he was Jewish. He was always married to a Jew. And to Lincoln, it didn't matter. He had a way of measuring people for who they were and what values they had more than he cared about their origin. Abraham Jonas later chaired one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates that took place in Quincy. And in 1858, he was one of the first people in a private group to suggest Lincoln as a possible presidential candidate in 1860. Very odd, because Lincoln until then had been a remarkably unsuccessful politician. Jonas retained a friendship with Lincoln. Lincoln even gave him a patronage position that he'd held before as a deputy postmaster. It's a paid position in Quincy in 1862. And they maintained a friendship until Jonas died. Now, that, even that is a story behind it. Of Jonas's sons, one fought for the Union, and the others, at least four, fought for the Confederacy, which suggests how complicated the issue of slavery was. It didn't just divide North and South, divided families. One son, a Confederate soldier, was captured and held prisoner by the Union, and Jonas did not seek any special treatment from Lincoln. But with Jonas on his deathbed in 1864, Jonas's wife, his second wife, his first wife, Sesha's daughter, died young. His wife appealed to Lincoln to let their son join his father's deathbed vigil. It was the first Lincoln had even heard he was a prisoner. He quickly arranged that Charles Jonas be released and sent to Illinois, and he made it to his father's bed and for the Shiva. Lincoln moved up the political and military chain, serving in the Illinois State Legislature, fighting in the Black Hawk War of 1832 as a captain, militia captain, and eventually holding national office for just 2 years as a congressman from Illinois from 1847 to 1849. That's right, until he became president, Lincoln's sole national experience was as a one-term congressman. All right, it was a momentous time. Lincoln, who was a Whig, became an outspoken opponent of Polk and of the Mexican War. In fact, he was one of the ones who challenged Polk on the casus belli. The Polk claimed that the Mexicans had crossed into a U.S. territory, and Lincoln wanted proof. He said, no, he just assumes the American army crossed first into Mexican territory. For that, he lost support in Illinois. But in any event, Lincoln had promised to serve only one term. He supported Taylor in the election of 1848, but after Taylor won, Lincoln just returned to his law practice. Lincoln was a moderate opponent of slavery in a time when opponents of slavery were divided between people who vehemently opposed it as sinful and immoral, and those who opposed it because it violated human dignity and a core principle of the Declaration of Independence. Lincoln tended towards the second, although he grew to see slavery as morally repugnant, but his main objective at all times until 1863 was to keep the Union together. Now, all of this, even let the South have the slavery, just don't divide the country. Lincoln's attitudes were first fleshed out and publicized in his Peoria speech in 1854, in which he was responding to Senator Stephen Douglas's support of the Kansas-Missouri Act. In fact, Douglas had drafted it. It made Lincoln a national figure, albeit without any political base. So part of it I cited last week, but Lincoln spoke for 3 hours, stating, among other things, I hate it, meaning slavery, because of the monstrous injustice of slavery itself. I hate it because it deprives our Republican example of its just influence in the world. And notice again, the argument was that slavery should not be extended, not that it should be ended. And then Lincoln said, nearly 80 years ago, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. But now from that beginning, we have run down to the other declaration that for some men to enslave others is a sacred right of self-government. These principles cannot stand together. They are as opposite as God and mammon, and whoever holds to the one must despise the other. the Kansas-Nebraska Act passed anyway and marked a sea change in the approach to slavery and really hastened the war as well. There were many different views, but very few, including Lincoln, as I mentioned, felt that slavery should be prohibited. The best they hoped for was it should not extend westward and then gradually would disappear from the South. But the Kansas-Nebraska Act sent a clear message that the South was intent on expanding slavery into newly created states, not so much because the South needed slave labor, but because the South did not want to add more congressmen and senators from new free states who might vote against slavery and then end it through the legislative process. Lincoln returned to Springfield to practice law in the late 1840s, something he did after every lost political campaign. People were drawn to him and he to them, and he made no distinction between backgrounds or religion, which is very rare for the time. In Springfield, he met and befriended a German Jew named Julius Hammerslow, who was a businessman, a clothing store owner in Springfield, who was much younger than Lincoln by about 20 years, but he became Lincoln's friend, a frequent visitor to the White House later, and even attended Lincoln's first inauguration. And despite the fact that there were relatively few Jews in America at the time, a half of 1% of the population, Lincoln had Jews as friends, social friends, clients, political supporters. With them, he spoke the language of the Bible, whether they recognized it or not. And he even counted among his friends and supporters Jews who were religious, Shomrei Mitzvos. Lincoln decided to campaign for the United States Senate in 1858 against Stephen Douglas, and those were the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates in which Lincoln reached new heights of oratory, creating phrases that would endure in American history. A house divided against itself cannot stand. That's a paraphrase of the Gospels, but nonetheless. And then, I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. In Quincy, his friend Abraham Jonas prepped him for the debate. And Jonas' son Edward later remembered how playful Lincoln was with him and other children, sneaking up behind him, tickling his ear with a straw, then turning away when the kid starts rubbing his ear. Abusive, huh? No. Lincoln gained a national reputation through the debates. In the election, he won the popular vote, but as you know, the senators were then elected by the legislature, and they elected Douglas anyway. So Lincoln was dispirited, but not broken. He said, "The cause of civil liberty must not be surrendered at the end of one or even 100 defeats." True to his droll form, he was asked how he felt losing, and he said he feels like a boy whose finger was badly squeezed, too big to cry and too badly hurt to laugh. Worse, Lincoln, who had taken off a year to campaign, taken from his law practice, was now broke. And without any expectation of ever re-entering politics, he again returned to his law practice. His friends and supporters, including Jonas, began meeting with influential politicians and journalists. Horace Greeley was one of them when he visited Springfield to float Lincoln's name for president in 1860. If you think about it, it's strange because, again, he'd won very little politically. But Jonas and the others knew that the election in 1860 would be very divided and very divisive. And so it was, and Lincoln was able to take advantage of that. So Lincoln became the first Republican to win the presidency, the second Republican candidate. John Fremont had lost in 1856. The Republican Party was more or less an outgrowth of the Whig Party that was defunct. You know, it's strange when you consider how modern American politics has played itself out. The Democrats, like Douglas, Stephen Douglas was a Democrat, they were the pro-slavery party. It was Lincoln, the Republican, who would fight the war and free the black slaves. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed with 80% of the House Republicans voting for it and 82% of the Senate Republicans voting for it, as opposed to just 63% and 69% of the Democrats But most blacks today, like Jews, are reflexive Democrats. Even if the legacy of racism was primarily, not exclusively, primarily a Democratic matter. Go figure. Now, the presidential election of 1860 was one of the most contested, and the leading Republican candidate was a diehard anti-slavery advocate named William Seward, who was the former New York governor and now U.S. senator. Seward was the favorite, and his experience, he served in many different capacities in government, his experience and the expectation was that he would be the nominee far exceeded that of Lincoln. Seward was so confident that he embarked on a world tour in 1859, including a visit to Yerushalayim, exceedingly rare in those days, the first presidential aspirant ever to do so, and he wasn't courting the Jewish vote in Yerushalayim. That much is true. Now, Lincoln was helped. The convention took place in Chicago, which was Lincoln's home turf. You know, Springfield's not that far away, so to the south of Chicago. And Lincoln's strategy was masterminded by his local supporters, including Jonas. Their goal was to deny Seward a nomination, a first ballot majority, and so it was. Seward won a plurality, but not a majority, after which support quickly shifted to Lincoln because they stacked the convention hall with Lincoln supporters from Illinois, and when his name was mentioned, they gave him a rousing ovation, and just by numbers exceeded the number of Seward supporters that were there. Lincoln won the nomination on the third ballot. Seward eventually became Lincoln's Secretary of State. Louis Dembitz from Kentucky was a Lincoln delegate, name familiar to us because his nephew, Louis Dembitz Brandeis, became the first Jewish Supreme Court justice a half century later. Lincoln was probably the first candidate ever to actually factor in the Jewish vote. And Jonas sat there in Quincy, Illinois, like a Yiddish Karl Rove, and he said their strategy should be to focus on outsiders. They knew they wouldn't get the southern vote, but they had to win the electoral votes in as many northern states as possible. So Jonas didn't think that the Catholics would support Lincoln, so they should concentrate on attracting liberal and free-thinking Germans, the anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant know-nothings that party had lost in 56, and the Israelites. Well, Lincoln, for his part, even though he wanted the support of the know-nothings, he distanced himself from them. They were a Whig offshoot. Saying, remember, they're anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic, how can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? Which is a cogent argument. And he noted how far we had come since all men are created equal in the Declaration. He said, when the know-nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal, except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. And to Lincoln, this was intolerable. Lincoln campaigned extensively, traveled through a good part of the North and Midwest. In Cincinnati, the picture's in the book, he spoke on top of a building over a store sign that said Rosenbaum's. Rosenbaum was the support of Lincoln, who owned the store. He traveled into Kansas, lured by another German Jew named Jonas Wallman, for whom the Wallman skating rink in Central Park is named, and whose descendants founded H&R Block, the tax preparation company. February 27th, 1860, Lincoln's in New York. Famous speech at Cooper Union. One of his most famous speeches, and he ended the speech by saying, let us have faith that right makes might. He coined the phrase, right makes might, and in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. But again, Lincoln's duty, as he understood it, was not to end slavery, but just to prevent its spread, and above all, keep the Union together. And that became the theme. It electrified the audience, even if some preferred that Lincoln would just advocate an end to slavery altogether. During the campaign, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858 were published, became a bestseller, and this also helped Lincoln. In the election, he was opposed by Stephen Douglas, among others, but Douglas came in fourth place as the Democratic nominee. the Democrats were split between northern and southern factions, something that would last another century. So Lincoln won the presidency with 39.8% of the vote, less than 40%, 180 electoral votes, defeating the vice president, Buchanan's vice president, John Breckinridge of Kentucky, who received 18% of the vote, 72 electoral votes, but 11 states, seven of which would secede from the Union before Lincoln took office. Breckinridge himself became a Confederate general. Douglas won 29.5% of the vote, but only one state, Missouri. Lincoln won no state at all in the South, and the threats of secession preceded his election. In the audience at Cooper Union was an American Jew from the South named Abram Dittenhofer, who had become an anti-slavery advocate, remember, from the South, anti-slavery advocate while a student at Columbia, and he brought along his father as well, and he was moved mainly by Jewish considerations. The Torah, especially when Senator Benjamin Wade had characterized Senator Judah Benjamin of Louisiana, big pro-slavery advocate, Wade said on the Senate floor that Benjamin was, I quote, an Israelite with Egyptian principles, which is a very cutting phrase, but it just struck a chord with Dittenhofer, who remembered Avodim Hayinu Lefara B'Mitzrayim. How could we then uphold slavery in America? On December 20th, 1860, a little over a month after the election, South Carolina seceded. Legislature passed a resolution. South Carolina has resumed her sovereign powers. Six other states would follow in short order, with Judah Benjamin leaving the U.S. Senate with a flourish. He was always a good speaker also. Benjamin said at the end of his oration, "The fortunes of war may be adverse to our arms. You may carry desolation into our peaceful land, and with torch and fire you may set our cities in flames, but you can never subjugate us. You can never convert the free sons of the soil into vassals, paying tribute to your power. You can never degrade them to a servile and inferior race. Never, never. And to enslave other human beings is really hard to imagine." And with that, Benjamin resigned from the U.S. Senate and became one of the leaders of the Confederacy. The Jews were split. The main issue was not slavery as much as it was the fate of the Union. And it made for strange bedfellows. Take just the rabbis, some of whom we discussed last week. Rav Bernard Illowy, pro-slavery. In Baltimore, hated Lincoln, moved to the South, to New Orleans. But Rabbi Morris Rafal, remember we discussed him last week, he of the pro-slavery speech that day, January 4th, 1861, designated by President Buchanan as a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer throughout the Union. He, Rafal, who defended slavery as based on the Bible, say he was a supporter of Douglas. But after the election, he warmly supported Lincoln because Lincoln prioritized keeping the Union together. Many, maybe most, New York Jews, largest Jewish city at the time, New York, then as now, wanted stability and order because that's always good for religious minorities, but it's also because so many Jews, then as now, were in the garment business and they relied on Southern cotton for the raw material. They didn't want to be cut off to the southern market. Isaac Meir Wise, leading Reform rabbi, hated Lincoln as a primitive, called him a primitive, and he feared the war that he said Lincoln would provoke. When Lincoln came through Cincinnati on his way to Washington for the inauguration, Wise mocked the crowds that came to see him. I quote, "The Philistines from all corners of the land congregate around their Dagon and worship him." Remember the story of Shimshon. Dagon was the idol of the Plishtim. Conversely, there were abolitionists who wanted freedom for blacks but hated Jews. One of the most famous, maybe the most famous, William Lloyd Garrison, castigated Mordechai Manuel Noah who was pro-slavery, as we discussed last week. He called him, I quote, a lineal descendant of the monsters who nailed Jesus to the cross. That's a personal crack. It's hard to know for sure, but since Lincoln lost New York City, it seems that most Jews voted for the Democrat, Douglas, with a Democrat, then as now, and against Lincoln. He did win the Jews of Chicago, but in fact, the most warmly pro-Jewish candidate ever did not win the Jewish vote, and that has also happened repeatedly. Now, much is known about Lincoln because he was an inveterate letter writer. He was clean-shaven until right before the election. Why'd he grow a beard? So he cited a letter he received from a 12-year-old girl, Grace Bedell, who wrote to him, Mr. Lincoln, it's a long letter, it's in the book too, your face is too thin. If you grow whiskers, the women will like it, and they'll convince their husbands to vote for you. Remember, women didn't vote them. Lincoln wrote back to her, having never worn whiskers, do not think people will call it a piece of silly affection if I were to begin now? But grow it he did in October of 1860. And for the next 50 years, every elected president had facial hair except for William McKinley until Wilson's time. And since Wilson, nothing. I'm out of the running. Lincoln was already warned against possible assassination attempts, warned by Abraham Jonas, among others. Even before his inauguration, he actually had to sneak into Washington. Remember, Washington straddles the border between North and South, and Maryland had really Southern sympathies as well. He sneaked into Washington late February, in the middle of the night, so as not to draw attention to himself. Lincoln had also befriended some Chicago Jews, including one, Abraham Cohn, who was a co-founder of the first shul in Chicago, who sent Lincoln, before his inauguration, an American flag in which the six white stripes of the flag had printed on them in Hebrew the psukim from the Yehoshua, the first parak, read the haftar for Simchas Torah, ending with Halotzi v'sicha chazak v'amatz, al tarotz v'al techos, kimcha Hashem Elokecha b'chol asher teilech. I've commanded you, be strong and of good courage, do not fear, do not cower, for God is with you in every way that you go. And Jews, to the extent that they did attend, they could attend the inaugural balls in Washington. One who also befriended Lincoln, a well-known printer in Washington D.C., Adolphus Solomons, known to everyone as an Orthodox Jew, a Shomer Shabbos, he was listed as the manager at one of the balls. And of course, many Jews came to see Lincoln because they were seeking government jobs, as dispensing patronage was one of any president's responsibilities or burdens. Lincoln took office. He himself noted that no president had ever taken office facing as many challenges as he did since George Washington's time. At his first inaugural, he tried to reassure the South that slavery would remain and that what he desired most was the Union. And I quote from the first inaugural, and this is all classic speeches, apprehension seems to exist among the people of the southern states that by the accession of a Republican administration, their property and their peace and their personal security are to be endangered. There's never been any reasonable cause for such apprehension. I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so. I have no inclination to do so before entering upon so grave a matter as the destruction of our national fabric, with all its benefits, its memories, and its hopes. Would it not be wise to ascertain precisely why we do it? Will you hazard so desperate a step while there is any possibility that any portion of the ills you fly from have no real existence? And he closed with this, and what wouldn't I give to have a president who could speak like this without speechwriters and teleprompters? We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Classic. Those phrases were his. Of course, whatever the sentiments were, they weren't to be. Just 6 weeks after he was inaugurated, the South opened fire on the U.S. Army position at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, and the war began. In 4 years, over 600,000 Americans would be killed, the bloodiest war in American history, and more. It was long true that more Americans were killed in the Civil War than in all other U.S. wars combined. Until recently, the scale just tipped in the last decade with the wars in the Middle East, when the other deaths in all other wars reached now about 610,000 or so. The war was a catastrophe, and it's not widely known, but the conclusion of the war was never obvious until just a few months before its end. It really was a terrible war of attrition. The first fear they had was that the Confederacy, having declared its independence, would be recognized by foreign countries, especially Britain, which also relied on Southern cotton. So in this, another Jew, apostate, but nonetheless, who we mentioned last week, August Belmont, he was a German Jew, converted, married out, had come in the 30s as the representative of the Rothschild banking empire. He intervened with the Rothschilds at Lincoln's request and threw them to the British government, and the Brits never recognized the South. And interestingly, ironically, the Union blockade forced the creation of a new source of supply for cotton in Europe, which was where? Egypt. It's when Egypt became a major cotton producer. It was not universally accepted that there had to be a war. If you think about it, many Northerners were content with Southern secession, and if the war was not to end slavery, but just to restore the integrity of the Union, so why should anyone die? In fact, today we'd have a hard time refuting the South's claim, the claim to the right of self-determination. But such a concept did not yet exist. Lincoln was constantly criticized for the war itself, for the conduct of the war, the high casualty rate, and the fact that it dragged on and on so inconclusively. He was not as popular as we imagine him to be. Several times a day, Lincoln would walk a block to the War Department to find out the latest developments from the front and the casualty figures and give guidance where he thought was appropriate. It was a brutal, wrenching, draining experience, but not as much as actually being on the battlefield where the weapons had been modernized, but not yet medical care for the wounded, which was still primitive. And of course, photography had started just a few years earlier, so the pictures of the battlefield and just amputations, people having their legs sawed off without anesthesia. They had no other way to deal with these casualties. And Lincoln had to deal with bounties as well. People who would avoid military service, conscription, by paying people to take their place, $300, not a way to increase social harmony. In fact, riots broke out in New York 10 days after the Battle of Gettysburg ended. Gettysburg, 50,000 casualties, dead and wounded on both sides, and not even the bloodiest battle of the war. That distinction goes to the Battle of Antietam in Maryland. I must tell you, we visited the battlefield of Antietam a few years ago, and they're placed in the battlefield where there's a road, and the army stood across the road, one from another, like where Jay is sitting here, and just shot at each other, as if they never learned how to duck. They would just stand and shoot, and if you got the guy in the first row, that was it. And you wonder, well, you don't have to wonder why the casualty rate was so high. In any event, these draft riots in New York, July 1863, which Lincoln had to suppress by sending surviving regiments from Gettysburg. 119 people were killed on the streets of New York. Famously, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War, meaning people could be arrested, held without charge or trial for long periods of time. All right, it's a presidential prerogative pursuant to the Constitution, but obviously was not very popular. Lincoln also spent years flitting from one general to another without any real success. It was hard getting Northerners to fight, and harder still to find competent generals to wage successful battles. There were major, deadly battles, often won by the South, who had standouts like Robert E. Lee. You know, Lincoln first tried to recruit Lee for the Union, but Lee refused to be disloyal to Virginia, the state of his birth. Famously, Lincoln could not get George McClellan to attack Southern positions with any consistency, leading Lincoln to once send McClellan a telegram: "If you are not using your army, may I borrow it for a while?" Lincoln eventually fired McClellan, and McClellan challenged Lincoln for the presidency in 1864. He lost, but his argument was, "Lincoln is going to destroy all of us." Lincoln didn't find his general until Ulysses S. Grant was promoted and won a string of victories coming from the Midwest and heading south, told by the Temperance Union that Grant was an alcoholic and a drunk and unfit to lead the American army. Lincoln responded, "Find out what type of whiskey he drinks and I'll send a barrel of it to my other generals." Now, Jews also sought appointments. Isaac Mayer Wise had complained. Remember, he was against Lincoln. He already complained a month after the inauguration, April 1861. "The present government has not given a single office to an Israelite." Now, this wasn't out of prejudice, merely because Lincoln paid so little attention to people's religious background. When he was so informed, he made a point of seeking out Jews, even sending a note to the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, that "we have not yet appointed a Hebrew to any military post." Now, one of the books said, interestingly, it was much more common for non-Jews to refer to Jews as Hebrews or Israelites in 19th century America than it was to call them a Jew, because Jew had been used as a Christian epithet against Jews for some reason, so he almost habitually called Jews Hebrews or Israelites. That was rectified. Several Jews became quartermasters in charge of housing, transportation, clothing, supplies, logistics, and some even achieved high rank in the army. One was Rabbi Rafal's son-in-law, Chemi Levi, who was an obvious Orthodox Jew. He ran into some trouble doing a little cash business on the side, and Lincoln had to bail him out also at Rabbi Rafal's request. Rabbi Rafal's son, Alfred, fought on the Union side. He lost an arm at Gettysburg. And of course, it was prejudice as well. I mean, we shouldn't think that it was a sophisticated society. A regiment in Pennsylvania, under the leadership of Colonel Max Einstein, fought very gallantly by all accounts at the First Battle of Manassas, Bull Run, but he was sacked anyway by McClellan, didn't like Jews. Lincoln soon after appointed Einstein as consul in Nuremberg, but the Senate rejected the nomination. Another appointment they rejected was that of Charles Bernays as consul to Zurich. So he was from the family of Chacham Isaac Bernays. Should be familiar with the Rebbe of Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. But this Bernays had converted to Lutheranism, and the Jews weren't much interested in him anyway, so they didn't go to his support like they had done for other diplomats who had been troubled. Chacham Bernays' granddaughter, by the way, Martha, was the wife of Sigmund Freud, just if you're ever asked. Jews were roundly accused by Jew haters of shirking military duty and profiting from the war. And that's a staple almost every war in history the last 1,000 years. But in fact, an estimated 10,000 Jews fought in the Civil War, 7,000 for the North. The Confederacy also had Jewish officers. One of them, Colonel Abraham Myers, was quartermaster general of the Confederate Army, and Fort Myers, Florida, is named for him. Richmond still has a cemetery, small cemetery, the big sign in front, Hebrew Confederate soldiers. There's an account of a Seder being observed in 1862 by 20 Jews, part of a unit in Ohio, all facilitated by their commander, later president, General Rutherford B. Hayes. On Erev Pesach, the men rejoiced when 7 barrels of matzah arrived, all ordered from Cincinnati, along with 2 Haggados and Machzorim. They couldn't find Moror or Karpas, so they picked wild weeds and ate them, and they noted they're all suitably bitter. And of course, the fact that Jews were on both sides means also that Jews fought and killed each other in a non-Jewish related war, something that was very rare but would occur again in World War I. Lincoln appointed the first Jewish chaplain to the American Army, controversial because the relevant legislation required that a chaplain be a regularly ordained minister of some Christian denomination. Well, that didn't work. The issue arose at first when Catholics asked for chaplains. They weren't considered Christians by the WASPs. And that was voted down, along with an amendment to change Christian denomination to religious society. In July 1861, a Pennsylvania regiment with a Jewish commander, Max Friedman, appointed one Michael Allen as its chaplain unofficially. He was not ordained, but he read Hebrew, was somewhat religiously educated, and he served unofficially for non-Jews as well, and quite capably. Another Jew, Reverend Arnold Fischel, he taught at Sherith Israel in Manhattan. He also sought appointment as a chaplain, even came to the White House uninvited to see Lincoln, who enthusiastically welcomed him, but couldn't do anything. It wasn't until September 1862, after new legislation was passed with Lincoln's backing, that the first official Jewish Army chaplain was appointed, Jacob Frenkel from Rodef Shalom in Philadelphia, and this only after the direct intervention of Isaac Lisa. The most offensive part of the war, from our perspective, I mean that involved Jews, and again, one in which Lincoln intervened on behalf of the Jews, happened at the end of 1862. Grant, who was then commanding the Western section and based in Tennessee, issued what he later called his Jew Order, December 17, 1862, expelling all Jews from his district. All Jews. His men had arrested a number of people, smugglers, sellers of southern cotton on the black market. A number of them, maybe most of them, were Jews. As that hindered the war effort, Grant decided he would not allow any Jew to live in the entire territory and expelled the Jews who lived there. It sounds bad. Grant later apologized. He may have been right, by the way. He did regret it. We'll discuss it again. We'll discuss Grant next time. He understood, he understood why Jews would oppose him for president, but he felt he had no choice. Now, in fact, Grant never acted fully upon the expulsions, didn't get the chance. The Confederates distracted him with an attack, but some Jews were arrested and mistreated. The Jews of Paducah, Kentucky were given 24 hours to leave, pack up and leave, and leave they did. But when Lincoln found out about Grant's order, he was appalled. January 6, 1863, just 2 weeks later, Lincoln issued a directive revoking General Order Number 11. And this occurred right after Lincoln made one of his most dramatic moves of the war, most courageous, the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, Lincoln agonized over this a long time because it changed the entire objective of the war, from fighting to preserve the Union to fighting to free the slaves. No less a leader than McClellan had publicly stated before he was fired, he would not fight with the South to free the slaves. And so it backed the South into a corner. No doubt it prolonged the war, and Lincoln himself had long maintained, if I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. All that changed with one stroke of the pen. Lincoln had told intimates that if the Union prevailed in the Battle of Antietam, he would take it as a sign from Providence that the time had come. 5 days after the battle was won, September 22nd, 1862, Lincoln signed an order that would go into effect January 1st, 1863, that freed all black slaves in the 10 southern states. And as the Union marched through the South, Blacks won their freedom, a total of 3 million in all, many enlisted to fight for the North. Now, the proclamation was not popular to Lincoln, who wrote, "I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper. But the Republicans were creamed in the midterm elections. The Jewish Record of New York denounced it. To proclaim the African equal to the surrounding races would be a farce. It was certainly new and unexpected." To a young Jewish lawyer, Simon Wolf wrote to Lincoln to congratulate him. Lincoln replied, "It was not only the Negro that I free, but the white man no less." Wolf later wrote a book in the first decade of the 20th century on the topic of Lincoln and the Jews. Lincoln added in his message to the nation, he invoked in freeing the slaves the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God. But privately he predicted that he could not win re-election in the fall of 1864. He never looked back. He had a popular saying, aphorism, "Broken eggs cannot be mended. You got to move on." But it was an act of historic courage. November 19th, 1863, the dedication of the cemetery in the battlefield at Gettysburg, Lincoln delivered one of his most famous addresses, 3 minutes, 227 words that resound through American history, panned the next day, by the way, by the Chicago Times with its dishwashery rhetoric. That's what they said. Interestingly, the most famous part of the speech, or one of the most famous, had already been uttered a few months earlier. Rabbi Sabato More was an Italian native, a chazan at Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia after Isaac Leiser stepped down, a huge Lincoln supporter, opponent of slavery. So he spoke in shul July 4th, 1863. It was a Shabbos. It was the day after the Battle of Gettysburg had ended, just 120 miles to the west, but the outcome was not fully known. That Shabbos was also Shavasa B'Tammuz, and he spoke with eloquence about suffering and the insecurity. "The dust raised by the feet of invasion has tarnished our escutcheon," whatever an escutcheon is. "Havoc and devastation rage in our borders," and he asked God to encircle Philadelphia with thy mighty shield and protect the lives of our inhabitants. And then he asked people, it's July 4th, notwithstanding the war, they should still celebrate independence, the event which 47 years ago brought to this new world light and joy. Well, Lincoln began the Gettysburg Address with those very words, 47 years ago, and although he was well acquainted with Rabbi Moray, no one knows whether that was the source. It is well known that Lincoln was the side act that day. The main speech was delivered by one of the great orators of the time, Edward Everett, who had been Secretary of State under Fillmore. He spoke for 2 hours. People had patience back then. 2 hours, and he made a deep impression on the assembled, but no one today remembers a word he said. Lincoln concluded, "But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, no longer remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Wow. Sabato More, by the way, later became the founder of JTS, not as a conservative place, but as an alternative to reform. And when they started to stray a little too much, he co-founded a new organization and became its president, named the Orthodox Union, the OU. One of Lincoln's closest confidants during the war, another interesting story, was his podiatrist, then called chiropodist, Dr. Yisachar Zachary. who not only tended to Lincoln's feet and the feet of his cabinet and many others in government, but he became a spy for the Union. Lincoln and the army sent him to the South ostensibly as a podiatrist on business, but he would send back reports on mood, on troop movements, and on any other gossip he would pick up. Contrary to his prediction, Lincoln soundly defeated the Democrat George McClellan in the 1864 election, 55% to 45%. Of course, the South didn't vote. The war had not gone well for a while. The Union Army had 200,000 deserters in a two-year period. Through it all, Lincoln spoke and wrote of his high regard for the Jews, even appointed a Jewish general, William Mayer. He intervened to free two Jewish merchants, Philip and Meyer Wallach, who had been accused of selling goods to blockaders. That seems to be a running theme. The war turned in late 1864 under Grant's command, and then General William Tecumseh Sherman rampaged through the South, such that by early spring, Richmond fell to the Union. Lincoln toured Richmond, the pictures of this, walked right past Kahal Kadosh, Beth Shalom in Richmond. Lee fell back to regroup, but the jig was up. At Lincoln's second inaugural, he gave another powerful address calling for reconciliation, which also was not obvious. Ending, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war will speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Mishpatei Hashem Tzadku. No, Ms. Hashem, MS, Tzadku Yachdov. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. April 9th, 1865, Lee surrendered to Grant at the courthouse in Appomattox. Grant allowed Lee to keep his sword and horse, allowed the men to keep their horse as well, good for plowing. With that, the war ended, but not the bitterness, not the rancor. Diehard Southerners remained and thought they'd been betrayed by the leadership and that the tide could still be reversed. Friday night, April 14th, 1865, Lincoln rode a few blocks to Ford's Theater to see a showing of Our American Cousin. It's a foreigner's impression of America. Popular play. It was Good Friday. He was criticized that, by the way. It was also Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. His bodyguard saw him to a seat, then went next door to get drunk at a pub. Not what you want in a bodyguard. John Wilkes Booth, a disgruntled Southerner, was a racist, famous actor. He had easy admittance to any part of the theater because he performed there so many times. Approached Lincoln during intermission, shot him point blank range in the head. A co-conspirator broke into Seward's home. He was recovering from an accident at the time, stabbed him 5 times in the face and neck, but he survived. Johnson, Andrew Johnson, was the vice president. He was also to be attacked, but that assailant got cold feet. Booth jumped onto the stage, yelling, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always to tyrants, and the South is avenged," landed, broke his foot. He was recognized immediately because he's a very famous actor. He fled, was captured and killed 12 days later. All the conspirators were eventually executed, sentenced to life imprisonment. Lincoln had no chance of survival. One of the doctors who attended him was Dr. Charles Lieberman, ophthalmologist, who cut a lock of Lincoln's hair away from the wound area. Lincoln lingered through the night, died after 7 a.m. in the presence of his distraught wife, Mary, never recovered, and others, including Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, who said after Lincoln died, famous words, "Now he belongs to the ages," which is a great quote, but some swear that he said, "Now he belongs to the angels." Also a great quote, but Stanton never clarified. That day, April 14th, 1865, Lincoln told Mary that when his term ends, he wants to travel, especially to Jerusalem. The first memorial services for Lincoln were in shuls, with Shabbos Chol HaMoed. At Temple Emmanuel in New York, the whole congregation got up and said Kaddish together. Lincoln was compared to Avram, to Moshe. Isaac Meir Wise opposed Lincoln, had a change of heart, called Lincoln the greatest man that ever sprung from mortal loins. That's in his "bone from our bone, flesh from our flesh" speech. Chicago Tribune put it a different way: the most horrid crime ever committed on this globe since the Jews crucified Jesus. Okay, you got to mention that. It was Good Friday. 20 shuls and Jewish organizations participate in the funeral procession, and a rabbi participate in the final funeral service in Springfield, although the national day of mourning, June 1st, excluded Jews because it was the second day of Shavuos. All right, we excuse Andrew Johnson for not knowing this, but shuls across the country eulogized Lincoln at Yisker that day. Naturally, Southern Jews, like their fellow citizens, were less troubled by Lincoln's death. Lincoln was the first president to be assassinated, the first of four. Over time, Jews grew especially fond of Lincoln, the first president ever to naturally bring Jews into his inner circle and make them feel like any other American. Well, just to conclude, maybe the best way to remember Lincoln is this. I started by talking about the fact that Lincoln and Darwin were born on the exact same day, February 12, 1809. Darwin was a great scientist who drew his conclusions from his data and from reasonable, or at least not unreasonable, extrapolations from his data. Some of it is proven, some of it is unproven, but in the best interpretation, he fostered a sense of man's humility, yetush kodmecha. Not only did a mosquito precede man, but ultimately man descended from one as well. In the worst interpretation, Darwin intentionally or unintentionally stripped mankind of its mystique, of the notion he's a unique creature, a tzelem Elokim, a personality that can relate to the divine. Lincoln's legacy was that he operated in a completely different realm, completely different set of principles, and ultimately had a different view of man. If Darwin kept his religion out of his science, Lincoln saturated his politics with religion, with an objective morality that's divinely authored, with rights that were rooted in man's obeisance to God. Lincoln: "Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under a just God cannot long retain it." Lincoln, in a sense, saved the world for democracy, the great American experiment that people can and should govern themselves, as he said at Gettysburg. But he also saw the appropriate limits of democracy by insisting that majority rule had to bend before certain innate rights that God bestowed on all mankind. In a sense, the last 150 years of history have been a struggle between followers of Lincoln and followers of Darwin. Lincoln saw morality as God's gift and challenge to mankind. Darwin did not. His followers would struggle to realize his vision, and his successors, all of them, would labor with the reality that whatever they were not Abraham Lincoln. I thank you all very much.